Good evening. Thank you. Oh, Zane, I'm glad you're here. Thank you. Honored guests, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the presentation of Dickinson College's annual Benjamin Rush Award. The award and lecture were established for the generosity of the late Wilbur M. Rabinowitz, a former trustee and member of the class of 1940. Each year since 1985, the college has presented an award in the memory and legacy of our founder, the esteemed Philadelphia physician, Dr. Benjamin Rush. The purpose of this award is to recognize outstanding achievement in the field of business or government and to honor an individual whose career has been distinguished by a commitment to the ideals and value of the liberal arts. There could be no greater tribute to honor and celebrate the intentions, convictions of Dr. Rush. A revolutionary and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Rush was passionately committed to ensuring the success of the new democracy and the fledgling economy. Rush knew that the new nation could live up to its own expectations only if it were inhabited by citizens and leaders educated through an approach to the liberal arts that was distinctively American. It was for this express reason, or it is for this express reason, that Rush founded Dickinson College, which he hoped would be the beginning of a national college and university system. Rush advanced a liberal arts education that would be useful and applicable to all professions, unequivocally, including business, law, and the military. For Rush, commerce and manufacturing were defining and integral components of the new democracy, and he was determined that his vision, a new distinctively American vision, of a liberal arts education would provide the intellectual capital necessary to allow the emerging nation to excel in these particular areas. As early as 1769, he wrote, and I quote, this is an amazing quote from him, actually. Of course, I think all quotes from Dr. Rush are amazing, but there is but one expedient left whereby we can save our sinking country, and that is by encouraging American manufacturers. Unless we do this, we shall be done forever. For Rush, an American liberal arts education was to be, as I mentioned, above all, useful, a concept hardly understood today because people assume that means vocational. It means anything but that. It is far more complex and yet so simple. While this approach to education was to be solidly and vigorously rooted in traditional studies, Rush also expected students to explore emerging branches of knowledge and to communicate creatively across subject matters, to connect the dots, if you will. An ability to make new connections across disparate disciplines would fuel America's emerging proficiency for invention and innovation, those twin qualities that would soon make our country a commercial and industrial force, although somewhat challenged in recent time. Rush also recognized that economic energy in a people must be balanced through an education engaging ethics, religion, and philosophy, and the arts. Rush's vision and legacy continued to guide Dickinson College today. We continue to strive to prepare our students to become the citizens and leaders of our communities, our country, and our world by offering them a liberal arts education that is both challenging and useful. We continue to maintain that a liberal arts education is the best preparation an individual can have for any profession. And we continue to encourage our students to venture beyond these limestone walls, to engage the world, and to explore all opportunities and avenues possible to apply their liberal arts education. At Dickinson, we are consciously integrating preparation for all careers, including business, throughout our curriculum. We are enthusiastically reconfirming a distinctive mission for the liberal arts in America that prepares our graduates to advance confidently a democratic nation through business, commerce, and finance. This is the legacy we honor tonight as we present the Benjamin Rush Award. We can think of no better way to express our commitment and appreciation of Dr. Rush's vision than by recognizing those who have demonstrated the value of these ideals through their successful careers. It is now my distinct pleasure to turn over the podium to Laura Takachi, who will introduce our speaker. Laura is a member of the class of 2011 and a classical studies major. Originally from Philadelphia, Laura has become an active member of the Dickens community in her short time here. She is a member of the college choir, the Classical Studies and Archaeology Club, and Kappa Alpha Theta fraternity. She has made the dean's list for the past three semesters and is the recipient of the John David Wright III Memorial Prize in Classical Studies. She is also a member of the Alpha Lambda Delta First Year Honor Society and the Classical Studies Honor Society. As a student project manager for the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues, Laura has been asked to introduce our awardee this evening. Laura, please come forward.
Thank you, President Durden. Good evening. My name is Laura Takachi, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this evening's lecture, Leading with Integrity. Integrity is a moral principle that guides each of us in our lives. However, there seems to exist in our society for a greater adherence to integrity in all segments of society. This is true in politics, religion, healthcare, and business. Here to discuss the importance of integrity is the 2009 Benjamin Rush Award recipient, Derek Hathaway. Mr. Hathaway recently retired in 2009 as Chief Executive Officer and Chairman from the Horsco Corporation, which is a diversified worldwide industrial services company. Under his direction, the corporation's market capitalization grew to nearly $5 billion, with 22,000 employees in 50 different countries. Mr. Hathaway's career began when he was 16 years old and left school to become a junior draftsman while taking mechanical engineering and management accounting classes at night. At the age of 22, he co-founded his own firm that later was acquired by Harsco, resulting in his move overseas to the headquarters in the Harrisburg area. In recognition of his charitable works in both Great Britain and the United States, he has received numerous honors. In 1998, Mr. Hathaway was a recipient of the Ellis Island Medal of Honor, an award that honors citizens for outstanding qualities in both their personal and professional life. In 2008, he was honored by Queen Elizabeth II with the Order of the British Empire. He has also received three honorary doctorates. Currently, Mr. Hathaway advises executives through his consulting firm and speaks passionately to business students and young entrepreneurs about strategic leadership and giving back to both one's company and community. He and his wife, Margaret, live in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, where they administer the Derek C. and Margaret I. Hathaway Family Fund. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Following the program, there will be a continuing the conversation held next door. Because the event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Mr. Derek Hathaway.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, Madam. Big support, I'm sure, if your experience is anything like mine in my long career, that I'm pleased to have the support of my wife here this evening, my wife of 43 years. We were childhood sweethearts, and so I'd married, and I'd like to recognize her this evening, along with all of you here who have turned out on this lovely spring evening to come and witness this award and to listen to me. The overwhelming feeling of warmth and friendship and fellowship is something that I shall long remember from the first greeting this morning. Well, first of all, to the friendly people in the office of the Clark Forum for their administrative abilities, for the communication during the long lead-up to tonight, the clarity with which they did that, the instructions that they gave me, which I hope I've been a very good boy and a good soldier in doing as I've been asked to do. Michael and your colleagues, thank you for the first contact that we made, and from my first visit up till now, the impressions that I've had of this college have been nothing but good, and I want to thank you for the opportunity of helping me find my way in my life after Husker. I am really enjoying the opportunity of speaking, particularly to students, and trying to bring some kind of practical application to the textbook theory that is taught by the professors here. You are, as students, a very privileged body, and I hope you understand that. I've started to do a bit of teaching myself recently, and I'm beginning to understand, A, the enormous responsibilities, and if you do the job properly, the enormous amount of preparation it needs, and the commitment, the dedication, and the respond actually to a call to do this kind of thing. Doing three classes a day, as I've been doing just recently on some days, is very exhausting. And I sometimes wonder whether I've actually retired from my day job in many senses of the word. So all I would do is to say to the students again, as I said the afternoon, this is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for you. Work hard. Take advantage of this opportunity. Respect your tutors and your teachers who are making this work of service. Why? Well, you're the customer, and they're here to serve you and your needs. And most of you are probably paying for it, and that's an even better reason why you should take advantage of it. But as I say, it's a great privilege and pleasure to be here. Thank you for this award. I've enjoyed the fellowship today, and I do hope that it will continue long into the future, as hopefully our relationship will increase in its intensity. I am very grateful, obviously, to be your guest this evening and to address the subject of leading with integrity. At the outset, I would say that because this subject is as old as there have been leaders, and as long as there has been a consensus with regard to socially acceptable codes of behaviour, I am not likely to be saying anything profoundly new. For millennia, people have been writing about and discussing and trying to bring order to society by writing laws, by then reflecting them in codes of conduct, and the subject of integrity and questioning people's behaviour and understanding the criteria by which we make those judgments is an age-old pastime. So in that sense, much of what I say, I hope, will be, in fact, a reminder. And if it's new to you, I do hope that you will listen carefully and understand my belief that conduct without integrity is antisocial and does result in bad results. There are bad results which ensue from conduct of any kind which lacks the integrity required. The reason why this whole subject has been raised over these past several years with such force and visibility is that there has been a tragic reminder that the marriage of integrity, although, in my view, and I believe in society's view, is essential, oftentimes they do not sleep in the same bed. Throughout history, in whatever walk of life, we have witnessed men and women who have demonstrated good leadership skills, but were not good people. Fortunately, there have been and there are many good leaders who are good people. And of course, we mustn't forget bad leaders who actually are good people. And we must further not forget that anyone who has a follower or a dependent is a leader. And I would suggest to you, not only suggest to you, but insist that each and every one of us in this room this evening is a leader of some sort. And so, this evening, I believe it's appropriate to discuss the desired requirements and characteristics of leadership, and then to discuss the marriage of leadership and integrity. My speaking engagements over the last several years have involved me in talking on various variations of this theme to a wide range of audiences. The people, I guess, who I bored to death the most were my own colleagues in the corporation that I ran. So you start at home, don't you? I think the idea is to begin in Jerusalem and then Judea and then the uttermost parts of the world. That's the model. So there's nothing like starting at home to talk about these things, because the physician, I think, first of all, needs to heal himself and demonstrate in his own environment before he becomes qualified to talk to anybody else about it. But I've spoken to a wide range of audiences, including commencement addresses at universities, leadership conferences, Rotary Club Zane, investment community gatherings, and I've put together some thoughts which, because they are based upon principle and not fancy or fashion, but are based upon principle which I have observed, I guess, intellectually. And of course, I've approached this thing from possibly the reverse way in which you do things here. I first of all experienced it and tried to live it, and then researched what made me tick and tried to understand why, and come to an understanding philosophically of why I behaved why I did. And of course, to do that, you've got to go back to Egypt, and you've got to go back to Rome, and you have to go back to Greece, and then all the great writers that have explained human conduct and human behavior, and those people that have set the standards, and so on and so forth. So my approach has been experience first, and then intellectualizing it academically afterwards. As students, what you're doing is you are understanding the academics, and then what you're going to do is you're going to go out and live it, hopefully, in some way, and get your experience later. But it's been a very valuable experience for me over the years, is to try to understand myself. In my office at home, I used to have it in my office in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. I have a picture, a small plaque, which has no value at all, but it has all the value in the world. It's a very cheap little thing that Margaret and I spotted in a Mechanicsburg craft show many years ago. And it's a picture of a Native American Indian who is in a canoe paddling his way down a wide estuary, which is on either side enclosed by massive mountains and pine trees. And then underneath there is this verse. Rivers flow, the sea sings, oceans roar, tides rise. Who am I? A small pebble on a giant shore. Who am I to ask, who am I? Is it not enough to be? The Native American Indian who wrote those words reprimands himself. And overwhelmed by the size of everything around him, nature, he could smell the pines, he could see the snow on the mountains, he could feel the size of the estuary, a small dot, a small pebble on the giant shore, and he reprimands himself to even ask who he is. Isn't it enough to be alive, he says, and I'm going to make the most of it. It seems to me that who am I and what is my role are high on the list of very basic questions. If you were seeking help and advice in ancient times in Greece, you would go to Delphi and seek advice and help or the resolution of your problems. Do you know that over the doorway in Greek, which I'm not about to try and pronounce tonight, it said, "Who are you?" The implication being that unless you understand who you are, everything else becomes very difficult, and you're certainly not going to be able to understand and interpret the advice you're about to be given when you go in and consult the augur, as it were. And it's my belief that it is critically important to distinguish our role from ourselves. And therefore, the questions of character and role are vitally important. After many decades in a business or professional life, some people actually begin to think that we are that role. But there is no role big enough for expressing and conveying all of who we are as human beings. No single role. The role of the CEO is and should be a vehicle for expressing some of who we are. The role of the parent is a vehicle for expressing another dimension of who we are. The role of the volunteer, of friend, of citizen. Each social role is a vehicle for expressing a different aspect of ourselves, and none, I would say, is sufficient on its own. And when we begin to equate only with our professional role, not only do we rob ourselves of something much more essential in terms of our net worth, but we set ourselves up to make a classic diagnostic error. We take personally what is not personal. Even the most effective attacks that come at us, those that are personalized, actually, that's our interpretation. They are actually rarely personal. When we take them personally, we make a fundamental error, and then, of course, our response is inappropriate and incorrect. We all have the normal human need to be important. Everybody wants to matter to somebody. Yet some of us want to so much to be needed and to feel important that we go to lengths to develop enormous expertise so that we can solve other people's problems and play a leadership role. Leaders, firstly, create powerful narratives, particularly ones that help people have a sense of who they are, of what they are trying to achieve, and of what their obstacles are. In its leadership role at the college for students, I guess that one of the major goals is to bring students in and get them to understand who they are and to liberate them. Liberate. It's a freeing up, isn't it? It's like the moth and the butterfly from the chrysalis. This is what it was in its form, and now a metamorphosis takes place. And now the true character, the true identity, the ability in an educational environment to try to discover who you are and therefore liberate you as young people. That's why I'm so supportive of academic institutions like this. It must be a major goal to find yourself. The second weapon that leaders have is embodiment. And the best measure of embodiment is the kind of life that the leader leads and the kind of things that he or she does on a daily basis. And if the story and the embodiment are more or less consonant with one another, then the leadership proceeds well. If, however, he or she tells story A but leads life B, then the story is basically an hypocritical one, and the leadership is difficult to sustain. In the glare of public media, one leader said, "I am not a crook, and the American people need to know that." If you are, that's a very difficult story to sustain. Another said, "I am the president for family values." And then confesses to the allegations that he desecrated the Oval Office with a student no older than many of you here today. If you do not embody the values that you espouse as a leader, it is a weak story indeed. And we must remember this, that leaders change the way, and they have the power to change the way that people actually represent the world. But leadership is not restricted to great national or international figures. Whether you're leading a family, a small business, or any kind of organization, you still have to have a narrative to convey and a capacity to embody that narrative in your own behavior. Today, with the eruption of all forms of information and the warp speed of communication, we are literally flooded with stories, aren't we? And the glut makes it very difficult for single stories, new stories particularly, to gain the ascendancy. Because there's always breaking news, isn't there? And that's probably a good thing for many, many people. If you're going to rob a bank, do it on the day the king dies, or do it, you know, because one story may well gain the ascendancy over the other. Long before his impeachment troubles, it was said that President Clinton was an incredible storyteller. He'd got a narrative, he'd got stories, which is good for leaders. But that he had so many stories that he was not clear himself which ones he believed. And I think there are three lessons here. The first lesson is that leaders need to be able to tell stories if they want to create new representations to get people to think and act differently. Secondly, storytelling and communicating are important, but if you do not walk the talk, and if your organization or whatever does not embody the story, then it will lose its potency. Third, the story that people have always been interested in, particularly today, is the identity story. The story of who we are, why we are here, what we're ultimately trying to achieve, what are our obstacles, and how can we progress toward our goals. Character, therefore, in my view, is important in the sense of what do I believe? What do I stand for? What are my attitudes? What are the basic tenets of my faith in my life? And how do these manifest themselves in what I do in my life and my behavior? We talked this afternoon, and we all know about kiss and tell, don't we? But what about tell and show? Talk and do. Ben Franklin, famous quote, "'Twere better done than said." "'Twere better done than said." Behavior is the final arbiter of the kind of people we are. Character is very important. Predictable reactions are the sign of a good leader. We know how he or she will react because we know their character when they receive this good news or this happens to them. We know how they will react. If we say it is going to rain tomorrow, they will be predictably disappointed in that. And the day after we tell them the sun is going to shine, then predictably they will be very happy. If on the following day we say it is going to rain and they burst out laughing, you have a pattern there of unpredictable behavior and unpredictable reaction. Well, when we told him that last week, he cried, and this week he's laughing. Same news. Oh, predictability in reaction is the sign of a good leader. Leaders need to be visionary strategists who are focused with their feet on the ground. I argue with that. Someone once said to me in an interview, well, you're known to be a visionary strategist. And I said, well, you know, visionary, I don't like that term. Visionary speaks of something almost kind of, to me, supernatural. It's a kind of external kind of thing. And I do believe that there are people that have had these external revelations, that they have had appearances of some sort where the future map for their life has been indicated and they've gone on to do these things. I don't doubt that, because lots of people have said it's happened to them, and who am I to gainsay that? But I will tell you, I will confess to you, that God never appeared to me in a dream and said, this is what you must do with Harsco or anything else. He didn't do that. No, I believe that the gift of God is the brains and the intellect to think and to reason and to be observant and to be sensitive to and aware of our environment and our surroundings. Outside revelation, no, but intellectual analysis of where we've been, the history of where we've been, and we talked about this today. No good futurist exists that isn't a historian. No good futurist is not conscious of where they are now. Where have we been? Where are we? Those are two very, very good clues as to the direction in which we need to go. King Agamemnon had an advisor called Menelaus, and he was his brother-in-law in ancient times in Greece. And Agamemnon called Menelaus in one day and said, "We got a problem, and I want to discuss that with you." And so Menelaus says to him, "Really?" And they debated the thing, and they just couldn't come up with a solution. So what are we going to do? Well, next door we have Calchas, the augur in the temple, and what we need to do now, we're at the end of ourselves, we'll go and solicit some divination as far as the issue is concerned. And really, okay, how good is this guy? He's very, very good indeed. So they walk across the courtyard, and as they walk in across, the king, still skeptical, says, "Well, what's the secret of this guy? I mean, why is he so good? Why does he have such a good reputation in which you have such confidence?" Well, he said, "It's very simple," he said, "but just keep this to yourself. You know, it's kind of an inside deal, this." He said, "First of all, he organizes the future, and then he predicts it." Those are the kind of strategic thinkers that are required. The people who are able, through analysis of history, through the present, are able to, in some way, say, "This is the way, this is leading us." And lead an organization in such a sense and in such a manner that they can predict the outcome because of the way that they've organized the outcome. And that's about execution. Execution. I use the term IFO. In industry, we talk about LIFO, which is last in and first out. We talk about FIFO, first in and first out. I used to refer to an accountant that whatever time I got in the morning, he was always there at the office, and whatever time I left, I was never last leaving. And he was FIFO. He was first in. Philo, rather. He was first in and last out. But this is my IFO theory, which is insights, foresight, and oversight. Gain the insights, gather the evidence. That'll give you the foresight as far as the future is concerned, and to meet the future and execute, give it the appropriate oversight and execution skills. That's the way to get to where you want to be. And the more time you spend on your knees looking for outside inspiration, you are wasting your time. You should be on your bicycle doing, trying to accomplish to reach your objective. That's what good leadership is about. If you do look, you will see. If you do seek, you will find. Not in some mystical sense, but rather by diligent observation of what's going on in the world around you and where that may lead you. Understanding history and the present will give us a strong clue to the future. How many of you know about Alex de Tocqueville? He's a great commentator, a Frenchman, certainly on his observations about the United States of America during his visit here. Maybe 150 years ago. He says, "They do not shift from day to day, chasing some object of desire, but have settled designs, which they never tire of pursuing. That is why," and this is what he said about us then, "religious nations have often accomplished such lasting achievements. For in thinking of the other world, they had found out the great secret of success in this. Religions instill a general habit of behaving with the future in view." And he goes on to say, "We should always strive as leaders to set a distant aim as the object of human efforts. And that is our most important business. We must constantly endeavour to show our contemporaries that even in the midst of all the turmoil around us, it is easier than they suppose. it is easier than they suppose to plan and execute long-term projects. He must make them see, this is the leader's job, he must make them see that it is only by resisting 1,000 daily petty urges that the fundamental anxious longing for happiness can be satisfied, proving that wealth, renown, and power are the rewards of work, and that great success comes when it has been long desired, and that nothing of lasting value is achieved without trouble. Come easy, go easy does not work. What works is work, sacrifice, and trouble. And it gives us a greater appreciation for the privileges that we enjoy and the position which we hold. He must work first. In the interest of time, I could talk a lot about work. But what I try to teach young people is this, that work is basically force times distance. A force is applied. Something is moved a distance. I'm just about to work. It weighs a pound. I have moved it 2 feet. Engineers will tell you I did 2 foot-pounds of work. Right? That's it. But something moved. There are lots of people think that they're working when in fact they're not, because nothing is moving. Nothing is getting done. And the testimony to work is accomplishment and achievement and things being done. Leaders get things done. They show, they don't tell. Another requirement of leadership is what I, and this is fundamental, it's not for the faint-hearted. There's an engineering formula again which says stress over strain equals Y. Stress is the force applied. Strain is something quite different. It's the damage caused. And Y equals Young's modulus of elasticity. As a young man, I learned this in my mechanical engineering classes. But as I always did, I always kind of applied these formula and principles in other areas because they do apply. Why is it that some people can be under stress in the same situation? In other words, forces being applied, but they don't show any damage. In other words, they don't show any strain. Not only that, but they show some kind of ability to ride the punches and deal with the issues. And the damage caused by their stress is less. And that can be measured because Young measured in materials elasticity. Oh, that kind of gives when you punch it. It gives. It's not brittle. And that is a fundamental requirement of leadership and positions of responsibility. What stands you in good stead there? Well, it's happened to me before. Last time the factory burnt down, I screamed and I was inexperienced. The next time it burns down, you say, call the fire brigade, we'll build another one. That's an ability to react differently when you become experienced. And you become elastic, you become able to absorb and to ride the punches. And that's stamina, it's endurance, which is built up over a period of time when you've been tried in the fire and you've been tested. And if you come through it, the one thing that happens is that you become tempered. You become strengthened by the trial, and the tribulation you've gone through will strengthen your character. Not only that, but it will equip you to deal with futures. Who are the best people to counsel people and console people when someone is bereaved? Those that have been bereaved. Because you've been through that test. Do you see what I'm saying? The experience equips you and it teaches you how to deal with these situations. And elasticity, stamina, endurance are vital parts. The biggest issue that people face today in every walk of life is the next thing I'd like to mention as a characteristics. Before we discuss integrity, I'm talking now, as we said, about the characteristics of leadership. What I see to be the major characteristics. And a good leader will have control of himself or herself to the extent that they manage expectations. Einstein said E equals MC squared. Hathaway says ME plus D equals C. Oh, okay. ME, managed expectations, plus D for delivery equals C, credibility. So you manage your own expectations, manage the expectations of others. When you make promises, don't make promises and commitments that, as a leader, that are, you know in your heart, are wrong, but they are going to enhance yourself in the short term. Because remember, there's a bill to pay on these promises and these commitments. And better that you don't get the office that you're seeking, in my view, than make promises that you know you cannot keep and be caught out on that formula. Manage expectations, manage them conservatively, and under-promise and over-deliver. Under-promising and over-delivering equals credibility, it equals trust, and that's part of the integrity deal. The leader needs to be passionate, to be enthusiastic, to be compassionate and to be patient. He needs to have a strong belief system. The best leaders are those people who have run their flag up the mast and said, these are my colours, this is what I believe, and this is what I stand for. And that's part of knowing yourself. And it's part of the maturation progress of individuals. When you start to question young people what you're hearing and what you're seeing, you are making tremendous progress in terms of your own, the freeing up of your mind. One of the problems we have today, as we discussed evening, if I go to dinner parties and or I go out to speak to people in conversational situations, do you find that, as I do, that you're hearing what was on CNN this morning, and you're hearing on what was Fox News, and you're hearing what you read in the newspapers that day? The media has an enormous power to not only inform, but to influence. Question, question, question. As we said this afternoon, live your lives in the interrogative. Ask the questions. Form your own opinions. And be your own person as best you can. Know what you believe. And knowing what you believe and what you stand for is all part of knowing yourself. Churchill said that leaders need the ability to go from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. Success, remember, is not the same as happiness. You can be very successful and very unhappy. Success is getting what you want. Happiness is wanting what you get. Did I really want this? I don't think so. I'm therefore unhappy. You can be successful, but be very unhappy. You can be very happy, but not in the world's terms appear to be very successful. As long as you're getting what you want, that really is one of the keys to happiness. Here's a great problem for the politicians who rely upon popularism and so on. At the end of the day, we must be independent of the good opinion of others, and this is the greatest challenge. We all like to be liked, don't we? And this afternoon I was reminded very graciously in a class with a question about some of the responsibilities of leadership, and it was drawn to my attention, of course, that sometimes the leader has to be the commander. He has to disregard public opinion and what's popular to do, and he has to do the right thing. And that can be emotionally very distressing and very demanding, but nevertheless it takes courage, and that's another part of leadership, to do what is right. And if you've got to send the troops, as the military guys have seen, into battle and perhaps to sacrifice their lives, that's a tough old thing, but that's what you're there for, and that's what you have to do. It's tough. Leadership can be tough at times. And the principal issue is, look, my boy, I know what you think. I know what you think of me, but I'm afraid this is how it's got to be. We have to do this. And I'm right with you. If we go down, we'll go down together. That's the leader. It isn't a case of follow me, I'm right behind you. It's a case of follow me, I'm right alongside you. And that's the important thing about leadership. But we do have to be independent of the good opinion of others. We do not abandon the emotion of caring about what others think. We do need to care about the impact of our actions and our behavior on others. But at the end of the day, leadership calls us to do what's right in the circumstances, to do our duty as we see it, and the duty that we've been called for. We need to live in the present as leaders. I did advise you earlier on to be thinkers and planning the future. But there will be no future if we are so busy regretting the past and planning the future that we miss out on the here and now. Go for the future by living vigorously for the present and executing the strategy on a day-by-day basis, and the sum total of the days may go into years. But nevertheless, you will succeed in your goal. But live vigorously in the present in order that you can secure the future. And here's, to me, an important one, if not the most important. Do not seek power over others. I do believe in servant leadership. I am your servant. What can I do to help you? I didn't need to tell anybody at Harsco for 15 years that I was the chairman and chief executive. There was no sign on the door because they knew that I was the chairman and chief executive. By example, I hope, and by the leadership that I tried to show the organisation. Not by what I told them, using power and authority, by serving and leading from the front, by example, by showing, not telling, and exercising power. Be a servant. Do not seek power over others. Having discussed this leadership thing and the characteristics that I believe are important, and you'll notice they're all qualitative characteristics. Their character matters. I'd like to reference a book by John DeFrancis called Reclaiming the Ethical High Ground. Of all the moral and ethical guideposts that we have been brought up to recognize, the one that for me stands above the rest, the one that I have kept in the forefront of my mind, is integrity. It is my ethical and personal touchstone. Integrity, as we know it today, stands for soundness of moral principle and character, uprightness, honesty. Yet there is more to integrity. Integrity is also an ideal. It's an idea. And it's a goal to strive for. And for a man or a woman to walk in their integrity is to require constant discipline and usage. The word integrity is a martial word, a military word, in other words, that comes to us from an ancient Roman army tradition. During the time of the 12 Caesars, the Roman army would conduct morning inspections. As the inspecting centurion would come in front of each legionnaire, the soldier would strike with his right fist the armor breastplate that covered his heart. The armor had to be the strongest there in order to protect the heart from the sword thrusts and the arrow strikes. And as the soldier struck his armor, he would shout, "Integritas," which in Latin means material wholeness, completeness in its entirety. The inspecting centurion would listen closely for this affirmation and also for the ring that well-kept armor would give off. And satisfied that the armor was sound and that the soldier beneath it was protected, he would then move on to the next man. About the same time, the Praetorian or Imperial bodyguard were ascending into power and influence, and they were drawn from the best politically correct soldiers of the legions. They received the finest treatment, the finest equipment, and the finest armor. But they no longer had to shout "Integritas" to signify that their armor was sound. Instead, as they struck their breastplate, they would shout "Hail Caesar" to signify that their heart belonged to the imperial personage, not to their unit, and not to the idea of Rome or an institution, and not to a code of ideals. They armored themselves to serve the cause of a single man. A century or two passed, and the rift between the legion and the imperial bodyguard and its excesses grew larger. And to signify the difference between the two organizations, the legionnaires now adopted a different greeting or salutation. Upon striking their armor, they would no longer shout "Integritas," but instead would shout "Integer." Integer means undiminished, complete, perfect. It not only indicated that the armor was sound, it also indicated that the soldier wearing the armor was sound of character. He was complete in his integrity. His heart was in the right place. His standards and morals were high. He was not associated with the Praetorians, who were considered to be guilty of immoral conduct that was actually rapidly becoming the signature of the defenders and protectors of Caesar. The armor of integrity continued to serve the legion well for over 400 years, and they held the line against the Goths and the Vandals and all of those that would assail Rome and so on. But by 383 AD, the social decline that infected the Republic and the Praetorian Guard had its effect upon the legion. A 4th century Roman general wrote, "When, because of negligence and laziness, parade ground drills were abandoned, the customary armor began to feel heavy, since the soldiers rarely ever wore it. Therefore, they first asked the emperor to set aside the breastplate and the mail, and then the helmets. So our soldiers fought the Goths without any protection for the heart and the head, and were often beaten by the archers. Although there were many disasters which led to the loss of great cities, no one tried to restore the armor to the infantry. They took their armor off, and when the armor came off, so too came their integrity. It was only a matter of a few years until the legion rotted from within and was unable to hold the frontiers. The barbarians were at the gate." Integrity is a combination of the words integritas and integer. It refers to putting on of armor, of building a completeness, of wholeness in character. How appropriate that the word integrity is a derivative of two words describing the character of a member of the profession of arms. The military has a tradition of producing great leaders that possess the highest ethical standards and integrity. It produces men and women of character. Character that allows them to deal ethically with the challenges of today and to make conscious decisions about how they will approach tomorrow. However, as I mentioned earlier, this is not done instantly. It requires that integrity becomes a way of life. It must be woven into every fabric of our soul. Just as was true in the days of Imperial Rome, you either walk in your integrity daily, or you take off the armour of the integer and leave your heart and soul exposed, open to attack. Our challenge is simple, but often very difficult. Wear our armour of integrity, take full measure of its weight, find comfort in its protection, do not become lax, and always, always remember that no one can take our integrity away from us. We, and only we, take it off, surrender it, and we give it away. The world needs leadership that it can trust. This is a forum for contemporary matters, as I understand it. And I guess, as I said in an interview today with Laura, the problems of integrity have existed since time immemorial. And people were as concerned about integrity all the way down the generations. But the world does need, as a matter of fact, leadership that it can trust. Can I be trusted? Can I be trusted is the question. Turn in on yourself. Don't use other people's poor behaviour as a cover. You have your own standards, your own belief system. Satisfy those. And I would suggest to you that when I hear, well, in defense of some behavior which was questionable, well, it was legal, I didn't break any laws, that offends me. Because there are higher standards than legal standards. In the criminal courts, of course, there aren't. But in the living of life itself, in a society that needs to be well ordered and well led, the standards have to be higher than. That's where we get into the morality, the ethical, and the philosophical. The law is minimum, isn't it? It's a minimalist. It's the minimum behaviour that it's the one hurdle that the lawyers and the judges and the juries have to jump. It's the minimum expectation. Be clear in our commitments and in our expectations. Be a doer, not a sayer. Remember, we are what we do, so we must do it right. Be transparent, unless there are agreed to confidentiality arrangements. Beware of greed and self-interest. Beware of speed and be suspicious of the motivation to cut corners in response to the warp pace of communication. The speed of modern-day communication is a great strength, but of course the greatest strengths are always the greatest weaknesses and the most vulnerable to abuse. Of course they are. That's a natural principle. How often at the moment technology is overtaking humanity and human wisdom. We must beware of that. We must beware of that. Severe dangers. Haziness. Laziness. Think. The major challenge is knowing the right thing to do. It's simple. Our understanding of right and wrong comes at an early age. Honesty versus lying. Earning wages and receiving gifts is better than stealing. Good manners versus bad manners. We know bad-mannered people, don't we? As well as we recognise well-mannered people. We learn these on our mother's knee and father's knee at a preacher's or philosopher's feet. Why then do so many leaders, so-called leaders, don't even seem to understand what they learned at their mother's and father's knee. Sometimes, however, what's right is not all that obvious, and sometimes we need to rely on a strong sets of guidelines to point the way and keep us on track. Well, my advice is, in this integrity thing, let the laws, first of all, be your guide. The everybody ought to know type, and those specifically relating to the uniqueness of your position. The teaching profession has its code of conduct and has its laws. Business profession has its... Every kind of profession has its own laws by which it's abide. The laws of the land and, of course, the rules and regulations which govern the particular profession. Be familiar with those. And remember that ignorance is no excuse. Understand the spirit of the law and consider very carefully loopholing or using technicalities or manipulation to justify actions. Let the rules and procedures be your guide. Let shared values be your guide. Let your conscience be your guide. And if it feels wrong to you, there's a good chance that it is. And let your promise be your guide. Please listen carefully to this quotation, again from de Tocqueville. But if what we believe in... Now, listen, this was 150 years ago. Do you recognize anything in this at all? But if what we believe in grows dim, men's range of vision grows dim. Man's range of vision grows more circumscribed. And it would seem as if the object of human endeavours came daily closer. As soon as they have lost the way of relying chiefly on distant hopes, they are naturally led to want to satisfy their least desires at once. And it would seem that as soon as they despair of living forever, they are inclined to act as if they could not live for more than a day. When everyone is constantly striving to change his position, when an immense field of competition is open to all, when wealth is amassed or dissipated in the shortest possible space of time, in the turmoil of democracy, men think in terms of sudden and easy fortunes, of great possessions easily won and lost, and chance in every shape and form. Amid all these perpetual fluctuations of fate, the present looms large and it hides the future, so that men do not want to think beyond tomorrow. In such a country, where unhappily skepticism and democracy exist together, philosophers and men in power should always strive to set a distant aim as the object of human efforts. That is their most important business. He must constantly endeavour to show his contemporaries that even in the midst of all the turmoil around them, it is easier than they suppose to plan and execute long-term projects. Therefore, I believe that as leaders, our primary business is to give hope, guidance, direction to those who we lead. And we must beware of that enormous responsibility. Hope instead of despair, optimism instead of pessimism, and integrity, which is trust instead of skepticism. It was William Shakespeare who penned probably the best known words, "To be or not to be." That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take up arms against that sea of troubles and by opposing end them. Noble-mindedness and integrity are powerful antidotes to the problems that we face in the world today. And instead of whining and moaning about the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune which beset us, why don't we put on the breastplate? Why don't we equip ourselves with the right armaments and ammunition? And why don't we stand up against this stuff that we're witnessing? Young people, the world needs you. I think it's generally agreed that the present generation have a lot to be held responsible for. Life is going to be a little more difficult for you, but one of the ways that you will overcome is to conduct your life and be a beacon in the darkness, to be the salt or the antiseptic by living your life, your leadership life, with integrity, so that when you beat your breast, the armor has the right ring to it, and you do know that at least your heart, your soul, who you are, who am I, who are you? You know who you are, then defend it. That's integrity, and the world needs you. Why don't we just now take our right hands and commit ourselves and beat our breast and say, do it with me now, integer. Let's do it, integer. Thank you.
Sure, sure.
In a brief answer or question and answer session.
It's a pleasure to hear you again, sir. My question is a request for your comments on the application of the concept of situational ethics in the context of leading with integrity.
That sounds a bit academic to me, situational ethics. Of course, ethics, in my opinion, it's a way of life, and therefore a standard ethical response to any situation is appropriate. To me, it's non-negotiable. You do the right thing with the values that you espouse and take the consequences of that. Sometimes that's very unpopular. Sometimes you will get outvoted. Sometimes you'll be even ostracized for the view. But if people will accept the wisdom of your advice and judgment and the way you've reacted, as often they do, you will find that vindication comes, sometimes a few days later, sometimes weeks later, sometimes years later. But I don't recognize situation ethics. If that's what you mean, I just say, here are the rules. This is the way of life. Be faithful and constant to yourself. Know who you are and live your life according to that, regardless of the situation that's presented to you. It's kind of non-negotiable. It's non-negotiable. Just do the right thing as you see it. Tough in a world that looks for compromise. Tough when you're outnumbered. Tough when they'll snigger and smile and say, well, yeah, right. Okay, well, would you like to leave the room while we vote?
I Thank you for your remarks. The obvious question I think many people in this room might have, and you've observed and worked with quite a few business leaders in the country and overseas, what in the world happened to some of our business leadership in the last decade that permitted so many to totally disregard what you're saying this evening? Mm. What went wrong?
Well, I think the answer to that is contained in what I tried to say when the world changes from ideals. In other words, we're all loyal to an ideal, and then we say Hail Caesar and we follow men, then that becomes a variable. The ideal remains the same. The variable now is the way this particular leader applies that. And of course, we've become, as a nation and as a world, cultists. We tend to elect popularists. We are impressed by rhetoric and promises and so on, and which seduce us in many ways. And they are also seduced. And I think this is the biggest problem. When Caesar's downfall, as we discussed a little earlier, was when he went to Egypt and Cleopatra said, "I'm a goddess, I'm a god." Oh, that's a good idea. Seems like a great idea to me. That'll go down well in Rome. And so he took that idea back and suddenly he was a god. And then, not only that, but there was a succession plan which allowed the other guys that were stabbed him and took over to be gods as well. And, you know, Caesar used to have a slave mandated by the Senate who travelled in the chariot with him. And he got the job simply of saying, as the crowd threw their flowers and applauded him, his job was to say, "You're only a man. You're only a man." And what happens is that the people get seduced by wealth. They get seduced by power. And this has happened. This happens many, many times. In fact, unfortunately, it happens more times than we actually realize. And anybody that puts himself before the institution and the idea of the institution really threatens the longevity of that institution. But as you have indicated tonight, as I understand it today from further education of me, you are committed to the ideals of the founders of this institution. And you have decided that those ideals are timeless. That is appropriate today as they were in the early 1800s. The buildings may have changed, but of course, buildings, it's the building not made with hands which is important, and not the stones. Buildings are to accommodate people to carry out business. Some are posh, some are not posh. What's important about buildings is what goes on inside them. And I've been very impressed today, more than you would ever imagine, by everybody's commitment here to the ideals of this institution that you are committed to perpetuating, because you know this: they work. And they are values. They're not financial goals. The financial things will take care of themselves. And I understand the economics of a college. But you've got more chance of achieving your goals economically and financially, if in fact you have a strong stand for what you believe, that people can identify with, and they are there when you run the flag up and you tell them what you believe in, and they salute and they say, "Yeah, I'm in. This is a cause worth fighting for. This is something worth supporting." So that's where I stand on that. Caesar died. Why? Well, because he was greedy, he was ambitious. And those aren't the characteristics of leadership. It's, "I am your servant. These are the ideals. Do you believe them? Let's all of us." And that's the thing. You've got to do it yourself, but lead by example. "I believe this. I live this. Follow me." That works. That's what works. Yes, sir.
Well, I guess my question is then, if it's all do it yourself, and I,
I'm one of the students of leadership. Is ethics teachable? This would be my question.
Certainly it is. I mean, I mentioned your mother. You have, I believe we all have an innate issue, but we can learn, as we said, ethics are the general consensus about the way society has agreed over time in order to provide law, provide order in society and make things as populations grew. As I said earlier tonight, one day someone in a tribal situation, they were all stealing from each other and borrowing what they needed to, and then one of the chiefs said, this has got to stop, because last week he stole this from him and he retaliated by killing him. So we've got to bring some kind of order. So it's all about public opinion. Laws are made because of public opinion, which actually changes over the centuries. And what was unforgivable and imprisonable 200 years ago now is generally accepted practice. What was considered immoral 200 years ago today is okay. So it changes. So there is a kind of, I believe, an innate moral compass with which we are born, and then we sit on our mother's knee, we watch the way society is conducted, and we move along. We're learning all the time about ethics and philosophy. I think the time you find out about that is when you transgress, and then you realize that these things do exist and you offend somebody. And so the sins of omission very often are the teachers rather than the sins of commission. I should have done this and I didn't. I did do this and I shouldn't. And it soon becomes evident. And you don't jump up and down like that and behave like that as a child. So be disciplined. There are times when you do this, and now it really is about discipline in your life. And I have to say to you, I think very often it is a self-taught thing. You see what works and what doesn't work. And there's plenty of guidance about this. All of the main religions will, you can get a book, whether it's the Bible, the Quran, whether studying this, that, and the other. No one religion has exclusivity on teaching you how you should behave. That's a fact. It's a fact. I don't want to offend anybody here. I happen to be a Christian believer. And that's been a guide for me since I was a boy. And if I wasn't doing this tonight and being a businessman, I might have been something else. But I chose to serve through business and running a business. So it does require actually a sensitivity. We need to smell and touch and feel and be sensitive to our environment. We know what's right and wrong. And if we know what's right and what's wrong, which is above the law, and it's a few degrees above that, then do what's right. Follow your instinct. Let the law be your guide. But as I said to you earlier, there are other guides available to you.
President Durden will now present the Rush Award.
Oh.
You might just stand right over there so folks can see. Ah.
Well, Mr. Hathaway, thank you very, very much for your very appropriate comments this evening. We thank you. It now gives me great pleasure to present you with the 2009 Benjamin Rush Award in recognition of your outstanding achievements in business and your exemplary leadership in a competitive global economy. And let me present you this medallion with the vestige of Dr. Rush.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you all, and good evening.